This is the Coconetics Podcast. Episode 42, recorded Sunday, March 10th, 2013. Meet my friend Dave. Hey Dave, can I call you Dave actually?
Yeah, you can call me Dave. Most people here do.
Ah, they do. That's from, yeah. David. David, I think most people call David's Dave.
Uh-huh. Yeah, in the US at least. Didn't happen that much when I was in the UK, but in the US, yes, they do.
Yeah. Hey, it's been a long time since we talked. Well, actually, it's been forever because we never talked before. But let me just briefly tell the listeners what I'm trying to do here. There are quite a few podcasts out there, a few just started recently, where some developers or a journalist and developer getting together and chatting about certain development topics. And I have had this Coconetics podcast for a while, and I even every once in a while I was doing a long break, a sort of a hiatus, because I didn't feel that the format that I had was really a great one. Because, for example, I could never hope to achieve the quality of macOS Ken doing a news show. He's really amazingly professional. Now, then there are other shows like Debug, or for example the what's this? I don't recall the name of this other show where he's also doing interviews now. The thing that I try to say is I tried for a while to do interviews, but interviews are mostly interesting if you are a really great English speaker and maybe even a celebrity like Guy English or the guy from iMore, or if you have some celebrity to interview. But that's not something that I aspire to do, because there are several podcasts who work in this niche. What I actually want to do is basically two developers or almost developers talking to each other as if they were phoning each other for the first time in, say, a month or so. And so just colloquially asking each other, so what's going on, what you're doing. And so this is kind of the pilot, the first time I'm trying this. And David Mendels from Jakarta has volunteered to be my guinea pig here. So, hey, Dave, hi.
Hi.
Can you briefly introduce yourself?
Yes. So, basically, I'm a physicist at the basic. I sort of gave up physics for 4 years after resigning from the National Physical Laboratory in the UK and became a full-time developer. And I'm back into physics plus development, meaning that I'm now a full professor in a new university in Jakarta that I'm helping to set up. And I'm setting up a center for mobile, micro, and nanotechnology, meaning that I'm trying to bring everything together. Everything that I've done before, I'm trying to bring it together and get some new sensors, actuators, all integrated with iOS devices. Roughly, that would describe it.
That sounds awesome. Do you have a membership in this secretive program that Apple has for hardware vendors to make things that are built for iPhone and stuff?
Yeah, actually, we've got pretty much all the Apple bases covered, because we're going to start teaching iOS as well, which will be first in Indonesia, and so we're developing kit right now. Our strategy is really targeted towards Bluetooth, because the most recent developments in Bluetooth for iOS are really making it worth it. and we can start to find some circuitry that can just be implemented pretty much everywhere. And then we've got our students. Because we're a new university, we can do things that that others cannot. And one of the things that we wanted to do was go paperless. So we're getting more or less 3,000 students starting in September, and they will all be given an iPad with their books already inside.
So do you use iBooks Author to make books for that?
Oh, hell yes. Yes, actually. I didn't really realize how it would be before we started, but right now we are really full into iBooks Author.
Awesome. Let me quickly ask you another thing, because I've been wondering, you mentioned UK and you mentioned Jakarta, and if you look at your avatar picture on Twitter, which is, by the way, at D.A.V. Mendels, you don't strike me like an Asian guy or like originating from the United Kingdom. Where are you from originally?
Originally, I'm from France. And by now, I've spent more than half of my life outside of France. And my wife is Indonesian.
So that's why
we came back here.
I almost thought French, maybe. Maybe Netherlands was my second idea. But French, now that you say it, I can still hear like a bit of the French part of your accent.
The French accent, yeah, that one is hard to shake.
Hard to shake. By the way, have you heard that the French are now forbidding the serving of ketchup in school canteens?
No, I didn't.
Schools are not allowed to serve ketchup anymore, except for, brace yourself, French fries.
Oh, man.
Why the French?
They're unbelievable. I mean, the reason why we're in Jakarta is partly that we didn't feel like staying in France when the new power came into office.
Oh, so you say you fled to Jakarta from the new powers in France?
Yeah, more or less, yeah. Yeah, that was that's a little bit more complicated than that, but France has been hit quite a lot by the financial crisis, and I was finding it harder and harder to get paid by my customers. Mm-hmm. And I was fighting so many battles to just get paid for the work that I was doing that I decided that I needed a change, complete change.
And clearing this up, you mean you were working as an indie developer in France?
Yeah.
Mostly iOS, web development?
Mostly iOS, only iOS actually. So, basically, only iOS. And then I had another product, which was a very specific niche simulation tool for nano imprint lithography.
What? Say that again.
I had a simulation tool for nano imprint lithography.
Nano imprint lithography. Okay.
So that's a kind of lithography to make microelectronics chips, except that you're making it at the nanoscale level. And if you want to picture what it is, that's basically the same as a waffle iron.
Mm-hmm. I'm a total layman in these things. Is nanotechnology reaching some sort of maturity where you can start actually creating structures and maybe even processes with it?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. So in nanotech, we've got really two branches. One is what we call the top-down, and one is called the bottom-up. The top-down, basically, that's taking a process that exist at the microscopic scale, so well-known process, and trying to miniaturize it. And those, we've got plenty of them that are working very well. The bottom-up part of nanotechnology, that's what we call molecular engineering, if you want. So you're trying to position atoms and forcing them into place so that they give you some interesting properties. And that, we've got only very few examples where it works. That's because there are some forces in physics that are very, very difficult to overcome.
Mm-hmm. So is this like where there was this report a few years ago where IBM scientists were writing the text IBM with single atoms?
That's a typical bottom up, and what they did is still very difficult to do. Mm-hmm. You can do it with a few atoms. You cannot do it. You cannot do it with everything. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, actually, when you're starting to talk about a few piles of atoms, so you're talking about clusters of 50, 100, it becomes easier actually to arrange them. So we've made a lot of progress over the past 15 years in that domain. But single atoms, that's really tricky actually. That's more a physics study tool than anything else.
Well, when making microprocessors, especially those for mobile devices, the past several dozens of years, the technology has always been like some sort of lithographic process where you have like a mask and sometimes I think even in multiple layers. But do you foresee that there will be a time when even processors like the ones that Apple creates will no longer be done with sort of some sort of lithography, but actually use nanotechnology?
So parts of it are already nanotech. Everything that is thin film deposition is clearly nanotechnology. I mean, we're talking about a few atomic layers, and the control is just tremendous. Now, the lithography part is something that has been interesting me for the past 10 years, and we've worked really hard towards removing what we call the barriers to Moore's Law. And you know Moore's Law?
Yeah, where every year or so the number of transistors doubles.
Yes. And do you know how many transistors we've got in the volume of one grain of sand in your iPhone?
I would guess shitloads.
Shitloads actually describes it well.
I don't know any number. Really many.
We're talking about several millions, actually. And do you know what's the price of one transistor in one of those microprocessors nowadays?
No, yeah, but you're going to tell me now, I think.
I'm definitely going to tell you so that you understand where the problems are. That's of the order of 1 nanocent.
1 nanocent?
1 nanocent. Okay. A billionth of a cent.
Okay.
That's how effective silicon processing has become. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly why the current silicon processing chain is not going to change.
I didn't follow that now.
Basically, the process is so efficient that it will not be replaced in part or completely by something else. I don't believe it.
So it sounds to me similar to why it's unlikely that gasoline-driven combustion engines will be replaced, because they have they are so efficiently being produced that no other process, even though the efficiency of an electric motor is so much better, it's been developed over 100 years or so. So it's unlikely that somebody can reach the basically output per monetary input with anything else than gasoline engines. It's like the industry has basically hardened itself and has become so efficient that hardly anything comes close to it.
Yeah, it's true, actually. It's very true for silicon industry, for particularly as there are less and less fabs and the barrier of entry is huge. For one fab, that means basically one factory that is fabricating wafers that are cut into microprocessors, one fab is in the order of $2 billion. So that means that only very few companies are able to foot the bill and start a process from scratch. So typically we're talking about Intel, we're talking about ARM, and that's it. After that, that's all alliances, and they're very, very common in that industry.
Don't you think that Apple would have the funds to pull that off as well?
They have the funds. They definitely have the intelligence, meaning that they're able to design chips, because the last two chips, I think, that they've put inside iPhones and iPads
even three chips already, the A4, the A5, and there's an A5X as well.
Oh, yeah. I always forget that A5X, yeah. They've got the knowledge, but I don't know if they've got the knowledge to set up a fab by themselves.
So what do you think about this recent rumor that Apple is talking to Intel to get their ARM chips processed? Produced. I mean.
That is a possibility. One thing that never stops to amaze me is that most of the people reporting about this don't have a clue about what they're talking about. Meaning that a deal between Apple and Intel, that's really a deal between giants, and that's deals that are negotiated in billions of dollars over. Over at least 6 to 10 years, and that's really possible. That would be a dedicated fab. I don't know where they would put it. I wouldn't hazard that, but I would guess that they would put it in the U.S. There are other avenues as well, particularly with Texas Instruments. Who has exited, I think, the market of microprocessors. But they've got a pool of expertise there, particularly in Texas, that is interesting. So maybe they could hire for this. Mm. But fabs don't run. I mean, you need specialists in order to run fabs.
Mm. I think that was the. Main reason given by Apple why they don't produce more, that they are missing a big number of mid-level engineers in the United States in order to do this kind of production.
No, that's really possible. Yeah. No, I can understand that. At the same time, what I've heard about the process in China is that when you need 1 million engineers, you just get 1 million engineers, and that's it. I doubt that it's that easy, actually.
Well, the thing is, you have a scaling, order of scale difference. That is, that the cost of living and what you can legally pay people is mm-hmm. so much lower in China that it. Nothing can compete with that based on price. So even if you had the engineers, you couldn't produce the same products that are currently being produced, especially for electronics companies in China.
There's some kind of truth in that. I think that the assembly lines are still pretty much archaic there. I mean, the way assembly is done, you know, that's not being done by robots. So at the end of the day, yes, it still takes hands to snap everything together. That said, I've never visited one of these fabrics in China, but that must be quite interesting, because actually there are very, very low numbers of defect products that are coming out of it. That's one of the things that is fascinating me about the processing of iPhones or any other phones, but iPhones mainly because there's just one model at a time and produced at a time, more or less, and more or less all of them are working. We hear very, very rarely about things that are not working out of the box.
Well, okay, enough about China and so on. I said in the beginning that I want to chat with you like we haven't chatted in a while. So, hey, Dave, what are you up to these days? What did you do recently, or what are you working on right now?
So, working on right now, I'm working a lot with iBooks Author.
Really? So, well, don't laugh. It's even I have installed it and played around. But so I'm fascinated that somebody actually puts it to use to make books.
So the way it's going is that we've got a collection of books to get into iBooks Author, and the people from Apple in Southeast Asia are very helpful, by the way. Whenever we've got questions, you know, we can just always ask and everything. But at the end of the day, it's very different. I don't know how you found it, or if you've had any expertise before with using some editing tools, publishing tools.
Well, Microsoft Word. that was my publishing tool for a while.
Okay, so Microsoft Word is definitely out of the picture. Now, I was more talking about things like PageMaker, FrameMaker, or InDesign.
I couldn't even afford Adobe Creative Suite or anything. Even now that they move to some sort of strange subscription model, I wouldn't want to invest into Adobe software, frankly.
Oh, definitely not. No. Oh, God, no. But anyway, most people in the publishing industry still do lay out their pages using one Adobe Inception or another. Now, iBooks Author, interestingly, is very different from that. It's really more akin to Keynote than anything else.
I did a couple of slide decks with Keynote, uh-huh. and I liked it quite to have sort of this. You create an object, and then you have inspectors to inspect certain aspects of it. I like this approach quite a bit.
Oh yeah, definitely. I love Keynote. Actually, I'm always processing all my slides in Keynote, and the fact that it's integrated with iCloud now, you know, you just move around with an Apple TV if you need one, and you're just able to beam your presentation from your iPhone. That changed my life.
Do you have lots of Apple TVs at the university with the beamers?
We're connecting. We're in the process of connecting actually all the beamers to Apple TVs.
Awesome.
That really changes your life, and that's only $99.
back to iBooks Author.
iBooks Author, you're laying out your pages as you would lay out a presentation in Keynote, more or less. And the tool is really good. It's not that flexible, though. And my recommendation, I think that the smartest thing I've done from the beginning was that I hired a designer from the US, Aaron Menke, with a specialist of digital publishing. And the way we're working is that we're filling up the books, and because of the time difference, is moving on what we've done during our night to lay out everything so that it looks beautiful. And in the end, it really looks beautiful. Now, there are a few caveats I found with iBooks Author, but more or less, it's very robust. We're sharing documents via Dropbox, and we haven't had any problems with versioning. That much is working really well, and the widgets that you can include are very interesting as well for us. There's really three things that we're over-abusing. One of them is HTML5 animations that we're producing using Tumult Hype, which is a really cool product, by the way. There's the review questions. That's a box basically where you can just probe. There's different type of review questions, but you can just probe the student at the end of a section to check that that he's understood what was in that section, and he can he's got an auto evaluation basically. And the third thing is all those boxes where you can zoom in, zoom out on figures. They're really useful, actually, to just show parts of a figure. That's actually really useful, and that makes the thing way more dynamic than a traditional book.
So where do you get the content from? Do you actually write these books from scratch, or do you sort of convert existing books?
We convert existing books.
Do you have to buy the rights for doing that?
No, because we are actually the editor of the founder of our university is a major publisher in Indonesia. So it helps, actually. We've got his book lineup already. Now, what we're doing is we're getting all the text back from the books, and most of the figures we've got to rework for digital, and that takes a long time actually. But hopefully we'll get there and we'll get more people on it.
You mentioned in the past that you are working on an iOS course. Is this also in the context of the university, or is this outside?
Context of university, actually. So, we're. When I started in Jakarta, I tried to find some iOS developers to hire. And there was none, so I decided the first course I was going to put together is iOS development. And the fact is, you know, Indonesia is very specific in a sense that the first mobile phone here is still BlackBerry. And the most used system is Microsoft, whatever inception they're on right now. So we find very, very few people that are developing for iOS around here. And we need to produce more, particularly because that's where the dev market is right now.
But now let me ask you this. If the whole environment is about Microsoft and BlackBerry, do you find it hard as an iOS guy to basically say, this is how I want development to be done? Do you have some sort of fights that you need to carry out in order to do that? Or is it kind of, the whole world has moved to iOS, so let's do that as well?
A little bit of both, but no, huge fights, particularly huge fights with the Android community around here. Actually, I didn't realize, as iOS developers, we are quite isolated from the rest of the world, meaning that we could interact with three or four customers and that's it, and live our life just like that, not a problem. Now, having to stand in strategy meetings with people from who are from a traditional Microsoft environment and don't want anything else than a Microsoft device on their network, and people who are Android developers and believe in open.
Well, yeah. There was this story in the last week about how, air quotes, open Google is. Well, actually, my question is, whoever said Google was open?
They did, actually. I think they did.
Did they?
I don't see. I think that Google said that they were open, but and they said that Android was open because you could recompile the core. But at the end of the day, if we look at it frankly, nobody knows what kind of data Google keeps on them. That would be my number one concern with regard to privacy. Number two, Google is not really open. I mean, they haven't opened their source code for instance, Google Doc, for their search engine, for their ads engine. All of that is pretty much unknown from everyone. So I think that open for Google means that your data are open to them.
Well, I don't think that they themselves either actually called it open, and just the terms open and closed are nonsense in technology, because what does open mean? I only know open in the sense of open source. Like if yes. I'm creating open source components, then I put all my source code on GitHub, maybe put a BSD license next to it. And that's open, but everything else where I don't see the source code and where I don't have a sort of license that allows me to do anything I want with it, that can't be called open. And I don't think Google is more open than Apple, or Apple is more open than Google. It's these terms don't fit.
I do agree with that. Actually, they don't fit at all. And by the way, when I hear that Apple is not open, you know, I think that their contribution to open source is way larger than that of Google. I mean, for even sake, they've contributed WebKit.
Well, there's another great example that is, why did Apple move from GCC to LLVM? Because the maker of GCC, Richard Stallman, who was basically the man behind that, didn't want GCC to be used to compile software that is not free. And because of this, they made it impossible to integrate GCC as a static library into other apps. And that's where the idea for LLVM came from, because one engineer said one day, well, actually, we don't want to take this bullshit anymore. We want to create a compiler that I can use as a static library and put it in Xcode or create analysis tools with. And so LLVM is open source.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the thing. And this other, I think, One of the reasons why people tend to feel Google is open is because Android is using this Java derivative. And people have always been saying Java is open because, you can't do anything with it. So I don't know how open Java itself really is, but it's sort of you have a platform where you can write any code for that you like, but that's true for most other platforms as well. no platform vendor tells you, no, you cannot make an app that does this or that. So there's only one reason why you might say Apple is less open than Google. That would be sort of the App Store. Like, because there they say what kind of software they won't allow. But apart from that, I don't think there's any sort of really striking difference in openness between Apple and any other company.
I think you're right, yeah. And for me, to be very honest, for me, the App Store and sandboxing model are just godsend. That means that we're pretty much impervious to viruses and all that sort of crap.
Yeah, Phil Schiller tweeted.
So for me this week, yeah.
Yeah, F-Secure and like 98% or 99% of worms and viruses on mobile devices are on Android. And some bloggers actually called this tweet sarcastic, even though it's not really that sarcastic. It just says, be safe out there, and a link. So how can you say this is sarcastic? That's the other beef I have with these bloggers and tech journalists that they take a tweet like this and have to attach an emotion. Yeah, he's so sarcastic. Yeah, when all he does is point out something that's obvious, that's there.
Mm. Yes, I tend to agree with that as well. But particularly in the tech press has been really bad over the past 6 months. I've seen it sliding down in terms of quality, and I don't really know why all of a sudden everyone has gone against Apple. But I don't know. I suppose that that will pass.
Do you think that might be because Tim said they are going to, quote, double down on secrecy, and for lack of actual Apple news, people need to manufacture Apple news?
Yeah, that may be true, yeah. That may be true. I think that one of the things that saddens me is that... that saddens me really is that Steve Jobs passed away, and people are just busy desecrating his legacy as if nothing had existed. And I find it, you know, hard to swallow, because these guys would not be here if Steve Jobs had not been. Mm. There would be no computer industry, there would be no mobile industry as we know it. We would probably still be working with bricks of and all those horrible phones that that we had before 2007. So that I find hard to swallow. And the fact that no one ever mentions, you know, that he's left, but he's left probably the best executive team that has ever been put together in that industry, together with a great set of values. Nobody generally mentions that. You say, oh yeah, here's the next device. It just works. Okay, Bob, off. Let's go with it.
Well, one thing that's kind of interesting is I try to follow everybody that's at Apple, where, you know, they are an employee, and there was something that, again, journalists called like a big brain drain that's going on, with so many people leaving Apple because they seemingly don't like it there anymore, and so the normal folk like us are kind of fearing if Apple might have too few people to get the next iOS version out of the door, or to get the next OS X version out of the door. You know, like the 10.8.3 has been seeded 13 times already. So why is that? Do they have too few people to actually test it once seriously and then get it out maybe after 2 or 3 seats? So why do they have to seed it 13 times?
I don't know. Honestly, test units are pain to write. Unit tests.
Yeah, especially for UI things.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Don't tell me about it. So, yeah, it's... I tend to act pretty much like this, you know. It's way better to let the software out when you've got something that you feel is robust and let the users complain. And to be very honest, they've got, what, 50,000, 60,000 developers that are part of the program? So let them just do the beta testing. Are you still installing all the betas?
No, actually, I couldn't be bothered. But the thing,
I don't have time either.
The thing that I do actually over the say last 2 or 3 months, I'm trying to make it a habit to create unit tests for most of the things, especially if there's a bug that I notice. Like right now, I'm working on a certificate viewer. Like, for example, if you have a HTTPS connection and you have a self-signed certificate, if you don't do anything special, you won't get any data, but you will get a NS error saying that that the host couldn't be verified. Now, in an app like Mobile Safari, you get a dialogue where it says the identity of this host couldn't be verified. Then you can view the certificate and you can accept it. And from that point on, you will still have a HTTPS encrypted connection with a certificate that you intentionally said you're going to accept it. And there is no UI in iOS to have this viewing of a certificate, and I'm just creating this. Now, certificates are encoded in ASN1 format, or more specifically in a dialect of that, a kind of a simplified form that's called DER for distinguished encoding rules. And I'm finding that there are things like, for example, there's a kind of structure that's called a sequence, where you have zero or multiple items where the order matters, sort of like an array. And I was having in my ASN1 parser, I thought, well, you couldn't have an empty sequence, so I was just returning an error there. And when I actually, with working with a certificate, I found, there is a case where there is an empty sequence. So I added a unit test where I had kind of the few bytes that made up an empty sequence. And then specifically a unit test for this case where then did an assert, this is supposed to be an array and this is supposed to have zero entries. And so the unit test first failed, of course. Then I fixed it. And then the unit test went to green. And it's akin to test-driven development, I think the pros call it, where you just make sure that while you are fixing a bug, you basically take an extra step where you create a unit test. But then the great thing about this is you don't have to write extra test code while you try to fix it. You just have the unit test that fails, and then you go fix it, test. Okay, unit test still doesn't work. Okay, fix it a little more. Now the unit test goes green. That means you know you have fixed the problem. And not just that, you also know that you have fixed it in the future. Because if you make another change that might break this test again, you immediately know if you frequently run your unit tests.
So are you using an additional framework for unit tests?
I'm just using what comes with Xcode. The OC test thing. Now, there's one kind of unit test that is painful to do. That is if you want to test user interface interaction. So you can, with UI automation, have scripts simulating user input. Yeah, go to a tab. Scroll down, tap on a certain field, enter something. And my colleague, Stefan, has set up a unit test for one of the most recent apps that we published, which is Urban Airship Commander, a tool for developers who have Urban Airship for push notifications, where they actually can send push notifications from their iPhone. And so for this, we did a UI automation test, and it's kind of funny to see this being remote controlled in a simulator. And what you can do there is you can see problems that where if you change something in a UI, it suddenly gets stuck. It doesn't find, for example, a button it's expecting. Or the other great thing that you can do with UI automation is if you have your app localized in multiple languages and you say want to have 4 screenshots, you can have a UI automation script that for iPhone 3.5-inch, iPhone 4-inch, and iPad does all the screenshots in all the languages. So basically you start that and 15 minutes later on your hard disk you have a number of languages times 4 times 3 screenshots. So it's like if you have 4 languages, it would be 48 images that you can upload then.
You know what, actually? If you complete that with an automated upload to iTunes Connect, I'm sure you're going to sell boatloads of them.
Well, that's the problem. Really iTunes Connect doesn't have an API.
Oh, God damn it.
Unfortunately.
I know that. Unfortunately. Well, I think that pretty much everyone would have rewritten it. But I was discussing with some people from Apple this week, and they assured me that iTunes Connect was high on the list of things that needed to be done.
Well, there is a bit of hope that this is actually going to improve, because just if you talk about if you think about screenshots, I know I remember in the past when I got started, there was a time when you couldn't rearrange the screenshots, but you had to upload them in the reverse order of what you wanted them to appear on, and then they switched that to this sort of Ajax system where you can delete individual screenshots and reorder them. So that's a big step, and. Yeah. Apple, even though all of their or most of their web things are based on sort of outdated web objects crap, I don't know if I can actually call it crap, but I think I have the right to call something crap if just changing a few SKUs or adding a few products on the Apple online store needs an hour downtime. So
yeah, the goddamn thing is slow. It's so slow. I mean, you can see every single time I'm in iTunes Connect, I'm tweeting, "Please reboot the Mac Mini that is that is actually managing iTunes Connect." This thing is a mess, but I could live with that. The one thing that I cannot live with, apparently, still not. That's the app ID. Once you've declared an app in iTunes Connect, it stays there forever.
Oh, can't you delete it?
No, you cannot delete. You cannot delete any apps that you've got in. Once you've assigned an app ID, you know. com.coconetics.myapp, it will stay there forever.
Oh.
You cannot delete.
Actually, I think I had this problem once. It's not exactly true that you can't delete it. We had the following problem. My brother-in-law works with me. So we have three people at Robnik KG. Stefan, myself, and my brother-in-law, René. And he had registered an app ID under his own personal account for testing. And then when it came to publishing this under the client's account, I would get the message, you can't use this Apple ID because it's in, already used. So what we did in this case, we had a contact to into Apple and did some magic there, and they were able to delete the Apple ID of the account of my, my brother-in-law, and then we were able to actually publish the app on the real account. So that there's two lessons in that. One, don't create Apple IDs on the wrong account because it's a pain to get them deleted. But the other thing is, if you have some contacts into Apple, it can never hurt.
Oh, of course not. No, but yeah, for people who don't have contacts in Apple or who just don't dare calling them to do that, Apple IDs are just, they're just a pain. I mean, I still got the Apple IDs of all the people I've worked for as a third party developer, and that stays there like forever.
You have them in your account.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I remember there was a time when this was possible. That I think in the last year or so, slightly more than a year ago, Apple started with the policy that you cannot publish client apps under your own developer account, especially if they are big names.
Nowadays we are obliged to get a developer account for our customers. Yes.
Like if I were to make a snow globe app for Coca-Cola, then Coca-Cola would need to publish that under their account, and I couldn't put it on my account.
Yeah, and to be honest, well, it's working. It's a little bit messy when we're reaching the end of the project and we've got to upload for the customer, but it's working. It's still manageable.
Well, you know, you might have seen we've got this. We Dobnika has got this product iCatalog, and this is a framework that's basically behind about 2,000 apps on the App Store, which are all catalog apps. And a few of these are still under the account of my partner in United States, who's got the commercial rights for making apps with this framework. But most of them, and I think that's coming up close to 20, mean that he's got 20 developer accounts that he's doing the publishing for. So you can imagine that that's quite a hassle, having to keep track of the credentials of 20 accounts and always choosing the right one to publish a catalog. I wouldn't be surprised if one day one catalog would accidentally be published under the wrong client's name.
Yeah, that's a mess, actually. So how do you manage it? Basically, once you're let's say that you're making a major update to DT Cortex, then after that you need to make a major update to iCatalog.
Well, iCatalog doesn't use DT Cortex, but we are doing major updates to the iCatalog framework. Recently, we did I blogged about it, called it third generation, which is actually true. It's kind of the third year of this framework. And so we did some great optimization work in there. And that means all these apps have to be updated or should be updated. Now, two of these 2,000 went through really quickly. And for a big share of the others, we are now waiting, I think, for 5 or 6 days, you know, this period until they go into review. So not to worry there yet, but yes, it is quite some work to update everything. And it's, I feel with my partner, yeah, I don't have to update it because I just tell him, yeah, we now have version 3.0. Go update everything, but then he sits and has to literally update 20 apps to the new version of the framework.
So basically, you're still doing the... How is it working? I'm interested in that because I've never had a partnership like that where I... Well, when I give the rights away, I give them completely. I give the source code and the people have to contract me again if they want me to update anything.
Well, let me give you...
In that case, you're in a shared revenue model.
Well, let me give you the backstory. 3 years ago, I was approached by these guys thinking they would be in need of hiring a contractor. Now, at the time, I had done a bit of research into the newly published Wired app and dug into the app bundle to find out how they have this structure. And I found they actually have images and an XML file that defines the structure. So mm-hmm. I was thinking... Well, it would be great to do some sort of framework based on this idea. And then they approached me, and I had the feeling, well, there's potentially something more in there. So I told them, well, you are not a software company, but I am. So how about this? I will make this framework. I will own it. But you get an exclusive commercial right to make apps with that. So everybody does what it does best. This partner of mine is in, their main business is color correction for catalogs. Yep. So it felt like a natural extension if they are already working digitally on the catalogs to also have something for their clients, which are big catalog companies, to put the catalogs onto iPads. So that's their business, and they're good at that, and they have a sales team, and they have people who can create the digital editions of the catalog. And I'm good at writing software and maintaining it and taking care of the backend. So that's what I'm doing, and we have as a sort of financial arrangement there. I won't go into the details, but it's an ongoing partnership where I take care of the software and they take care of the rest.
Okay.
And I'm really happy with that because this is what allowed me to hire my first employee a year ago.
That is good.
And from my experience, you can always work by yourself, but that's a very lonesome thing. I think every developer who has a bit of social needs should try to get in touch with other developers in the least in the form of developer meetings or chatting with people like we are now, or more preferably to work on something together.
Definitely. I think definitely, yeah. There are possibilities to interact outside of GitHub and Stack Overflow. Of course.
Yeah.
But I think that, the kind of partnership, I mean, the dream partnership that that every developer should look for is, because we are not social animals and most of us are not good at sales, definitely if you can find someone that you can trust and that who is going to sell the product and give you some feedback on what the customers want, basically give you a good orientation for your work, then yes, that's the best deal that that you can strike. But yeah, there are several things actually that that would take a too long time to discuss, like how you're setting up such an arrangement, all the contracting work, how do you come to trust people, etc.
Well, it's kind of the sweet spot between doing sort of long-term contract work where you have a client that pays you month after month to do certain enhancement, where they are basically the product manager as well, and a product where you just kind of get paid for 1 month's work and you do that and then you're done with it. I think that's a sweet spot in between where you own a stake in the final product as well, because I own that. So I have a different feeling towards writing software in this context than if it's something that I know next month I'm not going to look at anymore.
Definitely. Yes, unless you... Well, the other case where you may have to go back to the code is if you give a warranty to the customer. Mm. You know, fixes for 6 months plus one version up iOS revision for free.
Well, the thing is, that's always a problem. People who are not experienced software developers always think software is done at some stage. So they pay you $X thousand and then the software is done and they will never have to talk to you again. But the reality is, even though the features might not change, you have always edge cases and special scenarios that you didn't kind of consider, where you need to do a 1.1, 1.2 release, and then also, of course, new iOS versions where you might want to optimize something. So these
typical... my favorite. Actually, the new iOS version, they've become, they're dreaded because you're wondering what's going to break. But at the same time, you know that the bad customers, the ones that tried to screw you or that were not very honest or forgoing with you, you know that they're going to have to come back to you because the product is broken and they're going to have to pay you again.
Yeah,
you're going to be able to charge them for all the misery that you had the last time.
Just to give one example, orientation changes from iOS 5 to iOS 6.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy, that one was good. Yeah. The orientation changes, that was a really good one. Thank you, Apple, for this one. Mm. You brought me back two customers who were not really good, and I've been able to bleed them for all the bad that they did to me before. Mm. That was good.
Now,
yeah, and there were a couple of others, actually, that I remember that much, but some oddities. Oh, yeah, in the audio frameworks as well, some things started to behave really weirdly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we have already talked an hour. There are two more things that I want to briefly touch and get your opinion on. One is, last week was, what's it called, International Women's Day or something?
Yeah.
The idea, basically, as I get it, to remind us that there's still inequality between men and women. And we tech people interpreted it especially as the day where we actually think at our workplace, are women treated equally? And what can we do to get more women into technology? So you being a professor at a university, you're the perfect person to have an opinion on that. So
person to have as much problems as everyone else with that, actually.
Well, what problems do you have?
The problems I have is trying to recruit women.
So it's hard, isn't it?
It's hard. It's hard, and it's not because you just slap on your ad, on your job opening, you say you're an equal opportunity employer that you're going to have more women applying. So that's for one. For two, I've got the problem in both fields, in science and in development. In development, I think that that the situation is worse than everywhere else, meaning that's really a boys' club. There are very, very few female developers, and I find that I find that our industry is very sexist as well. I mean, the jokes that the guys make, they're the jokes that I heard in engineering 20 years ago. Mm. And that is typically inappropriate.
Let me ask you, are the jokes the reason why there are so few women scientists and developers? Or are the jokes just kind of a side effect of there being little? And now if you have a room full of men, they have a certain kind of humor, be it good or bad. So the question is...
I think they're a revelator. They are more a symptom than the reason why there are few women in engineering, in science, and in our tech industry. Now, in science, I got a lot of experience with that issue because we tried to address it when I was in Europe. And we saw that the problem is not quotas. Most people think about quotas as being the solution. You know, you enforce by law that there are as many women professor as men. And by doing so, actually, you're creating another type of of imbalance, and I don't believe that this is good. Now, at the same time, I can see that when I'm sitting on the board with all the other head of centers, you know, we're 34 head of centers here, and there's 32 men, 2 women. Mm-hmm. So that is not right. And there are very, very few female candidates to professorships, so there is no way that I can arrange that here. I'm not going to be able to hold the chairs like forever, although I really wanted to have at least a 50-50 50-50 balance. So there are things. Now, what we saw in Europe when we were looking at the statistics is that we had at some point up to 20 to 22 years old, we had as many female scientists as male scientists. And then they disappear after. So I think that maternity is what is creating the imbalance. And whatever we do, whatever we do to correct that situation, we should address the problem of, well, the problem. That's not a problem, but the issue.
The problem of maternity.
that's not the problem. That's not the problem. That's the issue of maternity and the fact that a woman loses 2 years on her cursus. And a resume is imbalanced, and in most institutions, we've got bean counters that are at the top and that are looking at things like the number of papers or the number of invited talks and such. So they are looking at quantifying what should not be quantifiable.
So let me get this straight and summarize it. I always thought that the problem was not that there's so much unequal treatment, but that female young students are not kind of encouraged towards the sciences and computer programming, but actually it's the problem that parents kind of push young women towards kind of languages, or maybe become a doctor or become a lawyer or something, but no, don't do computer programming, computer science, or don't kind of that. It's the parents' fault. But what you're saying sounds like it's not something that the parents do, but there is equality up to kind of 20, 22 years of age, and then suddenly the inequality appears because young women choose to become mothers. and then probably don't return to their science career as they had before.
Yes, there is that. Yeah, there is. I think that there is a big part of that, actually. Now, in computer science, the field seems pretty different. Actually, it seems that we are missing some female candidates earlier on. So I think that our industry as a whole has to change its behavior and open the doors to women in computer science. That said, you know, we've got some pretty successful CEOs in some computer related companies, and the most famous one nowadays being Marissa Mayer at who's CEO of Yahoo, mm-hmm. and trying to turn it around, and you can see all the sexism of that industry through and the journalist that is coming through each time she takes a decision that is not in favor of women. Or that is, whenever she's acting like a CEO and not like a woman or a mother, everybody cries wolf, saying that's not the way to do. As a woman, she should understand the situation of women, and she is typically non-discriminating, which I find quite admirable, actually. So, you know. The difficulty with that debate is that there is no clearly cut answer.
Well, one idea. So you're saying with scientists that there needs to be some sort of non-discrimination when it comes to time lost due to maternity, but for young female programmers, there needs to be some other method to actually get the numbers to be equal to males, right?
Yes. So I think that for young female programmers, that there should be some more done on incentives and recruitments.
I saw recently a great talk on what one company did. I think it was Cloud. What they did is they had this mission statement that they want to be increasing the number of female engineers, because like most tech companies they had too few. And what they did is they created a scholarship where they would basically work with some programming education company where they would fund young females stay in San Francisco. Uh-huh. They wouldn't fund the education, but they would fund their living expenses. And that actually caused them to have many, many more. It's not equal yet, but apparently this was one of the barriers that kept young females from actually pursuing computer science. Or not computer science, actually programming in particular. And they got many more female engineers out of that, because once they had a certain level, they felt kind of at home there, and so they signed up with the company. So maybe that's something that could be done, to have dedicated scholarship programs where young females can actually learn to program.
Definitely, yeah, definitely. Well, yeah. As you're in Australia, you know full well that we've had that with the European Commission. That's the Marie Curie program.
No, I don't know about that.
You don't know about that?
No.
So the Marie Curie program, that's a European initiative that basically lets young women pursue their research career by funding it. Meaning that young women who have just finished their PhD can pretty much choose wherever they want to go. They bring their funding with them, so everybody welcomes them, of course. And they can further, they can advance their career in that way. That's at least one barrier that is removed. They don't have to fight for finding the best postdoc with the boys. Now, that's not bad, but and that's arranged some of these issues, but we've noticed that that the issue of maternity leave still remains. And I think that the workplace as well has a lot to do with it. It's a complicated issue, but I agree that the scholarship is definitely a good idea.
Well, one problem I have with programs that only start in academic levels is most females wouldn't actually pursue something academic to get to a PhD, but they would want, when they are say 18 or 19, they want to decide for a career then outside of academia. And there's very little that would enable them to steer into the direction of computer programming, web development, or something like that. I think that's where you actually have to do something. If they then decide, oh, I like computer science so much that I'm going to study it, okay, then they can move on there. But I think this is the age kind of after... I don't know how this is international, but we have a certain age until which you have to go to school, and then you can basically leave school and do whatever you like. And this is kind of the age where I think they need to be shown or kind of nudged, computer programming might be something for you. I think doing it at the academic level might have a benefit for science, so real scientists who are kind of doing science, but that's too late for young girls to decide that they want to be programmers.
That's true. So we should probably nurture our school networks much more. You know what, actually? The one thing that struck me during that Women's Day week was that I didn't see anywhere successful women interviewed. A lot of people talking about it and always the same arguments and blah, blah, and everything. For me, the first thing I would do, you know, when I want to solve a problem, the first thing I do is try to find who has solved that problem already and ask them how they did it. That seems natural to me. And I've seen very, very few successful women interviewed about it. I think the only interview that I've read was that of Angela Merkel, but that with a female scientist, by the way. But that was a few years ago. That was an interview from a few years ago that they pulled out.
Well, I think the problem people generally have is with a single day having all the importance for the entire year. So at this one day, everything has to change. And the rest of the year, nothing changes. And I think that's kind of... women especially see behind this and see that is actually not serving them, really, to have a single day. It's something that should happen every day. That every day should be a women's day, actually.
Well, that's why we're married, isn't it? Every day is our Women's Day. No, but yeah, joking aside, I think you're right, actually. If you're, well, at least if a few people can just decide to implement a policy that will favor women recruitment or at least gender equality in their company or in their universities, then that day is useful. But it's true that... it's true that it's an action that that takes a long time. It takes like the longest time.
Now, I think it takes long time because the reason is no longer inequality. It might be that certain journalists write nonsense, but I think we are, most of us, grown up sufficiently to see behind that. But the problem is, you need to get new young people coming into the field, and you cannot make young people from old people. You have to go to the young people and give them kind of incentives towards becoming the kind of adult that you want to hire in your company. Because the companies that I've seen, and I've visited a few in San Francisco, for example, they all have women engineers and they all make no difference. And everybody, all these young companies, startups, they are blind to gender anyway. But the problem is they don't get anybody to recruit. And they are not going to, they are not doing anything to solve this problem because they are not educating young females to become the kinds of people they want to recruit. So if I am an American startup and I want to do something, I want to have 50% female engineers, what I would need to do is to have a scholarship or some sort of course where the output will be many more female applicants that I then will hire fixed staff as engineers. I have to make them. I can't say, yeah, we have policies and we have this is what we do. You need to actually do something with young women, giving them incentives to move into a programming career, and then actually also taking a large role or a big important role in their education towards that. Especially in the United States, the companies are very much reliant on, yeah, you need to have a Bachelor of Science, then we will talk to you. But internationally, I don't think that this should be, companies shouldn't be left off the hook like that. Yeah, we are only going to hire a Bachelor of Sciences. If they are serious about wanting 50% female engineers, then they need to invest in young people way before a computer science degree, a bachelor. They need to invest in teenage programmers, do the Ruby on Rails courses or iPhone development courses for 16, 17-year-olds. That's what they need to do. Everything else, yeah, well, okay, it's policy. It will work for the sciences because you decide that you move into science at a later age. Yeah, you do that with 18 or something, and then you probably have had some sort of affinity beforehand. Yeah, I want to be in science, I want to be a scientist. So they have set their mind anyway towards going to university and studying something, but that's only part of the picture. There are so many other people who don't have a doctorate or not, never going to pursue one, but still would be great candidates for being a programmer.
Actually, you know what? That's a fantastic idea. I think we're going to wrap up soon, so I'll just summarize that. Basically, old professors like me, we should do... first of all, we should go to schools and... we should talk to students that are 16, 17 years old, or let's make it larger, 15 to 17 years old. Mm-hmm. And we should offer some, let's say iOS, because that's what we are actually, iOS developers. We should offer some iOS courses or some training period, like a week that falls in the middle of the vacation or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a great idea. So the courses that we are running for professionals that want to learn programming, you know, we'll do that. iOS basics and intermediate and advanced. We could do that for school children.
Mm.
That's actually a great idea. Rather than just telling them what we do and how we do it and what they're going to do if they follow that along that path, show them what the path leads to.
Yeah, I think especially at a tender age of 14, 15, 16, very few people have a set idea what they want to become when they grow up. It's basically helping young people get some input that could factor into their decision what they want to become. So if you can show them building apps is fun, building apps is something that you can make a living with, then they will be more inclined to keep their eyes open in the direction what are the steps that they need to take to become a software developer. And then some might consider a Bachelor of Science for computer science, and some might see maybe there are some after work or summertime courses that they can use to kind of take in the air of what is it like to develop iOS apps, and from this kind of learn to love this. And once you have a feeling, I love this kind of activity to make apps or make games or whatever, then they have already a certain momentum that directs them towards what are the steps that I need to become. Oh, okay, it pays if I know some mathematics and some physics. Okay, let's study that a bit, because I want to work for a gaming company. They probably would want somebody with 3D graphics basic knowledge. Okay, I get that as a student. So, yeah, I think there's a few things that we could do as you being at a university, I being as a developer, to encourage young people to even consider sciences or iOS development or any kind of development. And we should never cease a single day over the coming year to do that. There will be many, many days when we won't meet any females, but when we do see some young females, then it is our job to tell them, hey, have you considered computer programming? You would probably be great at that. And you would meet many nice people like me and David.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, I think I've got sometime this month, I don't remember, but I got that plan that I got to go to a school. So I think maybe I'm just going to try that idea and invite them for a week or half a week training and see where this goes, if it helps.
Awesome. We already changed the world, David. We changed the world because you're doing something.
There you go.
Yeah.
The only way to change the world is to try to change it.